There are 76 species of rare and endangered plants in this forest. Mingan Island moonwort, kidney-leaved violet, fringed onion, maidenhair spleenwort. And I know them all, each in both its flowering and dormant state. Most of them prefer the damp, dark depths of the last corners of old growth up here, though others prefer the ashes of a new fire and appear only every 200 years or so. Still others seek the highest, windiest, most precarious existences possible, curled up in tiny clefts at the Spartan tops of mountains, seeking brief moisture from the slow, sun-glistening trickle of glaciers. I know all of them, and I watch carefully as I walk with the log across my back, across both shoulders. Avoid those 76 species whenever I'm fortunate enough to find any of them in the woods where I'm working. They say the list is growing by a dozen or so each year. They say before it's all over, there won't be anything but fire ants and dandelions. They say, that is my old life. This is my new one, my newest one. This one feels different, more permanent. Still, the old one or old ones try to return. My right side's stronger than my left, so that I use it more. By the end of the day, it's more fatigued than the left, and it feels sometimes as if I'm being turned into a corkscrew. And because of this slight imbalance, accumulated and manifested over time, my steps take on a torque that threatens to screw me down deeper and deeper into the ground, like the diamond drill bits I'd fastened to the end of the pipe string when I worked in the oil fields. And late in the day, I find myself once again daydreaming about those buried landscapes and other hidden and invisible things. A midnight run to town with four gleaming, sweet-smelling larch logs, 100-inch lengths, of course, and each one weighing several hundred pounds. A cold night, occasional star showers, pulsings of northern lights, sky electricity, coyote yappings on the outskirts of town, a tarp thrown over the back of my truck to hide the logs, one in one logger's truck, another in his neighbor's truck. So silent. They will think it is a strange dream when they look out in the morning and see the gift trees, the massive logs, but when they go out to touch them, they will be unable to deny the reality. The third log into the back of yet another sleeping logger's truck, and the fourth one in the front yard of the mill itself, standing on end as if it grew there overnight. Home, then, to my wife and children, and the pursuit of peace and balance. In the winter, Hope and I sleep beneath the skins, the hides, of deer and elk from this valley. There's an older lady in town who works on plow horses, gives them rub downs, massages, hoist their hips and shoulders back into place when they pop out. She says they're easier to work with, that a horse won't tense up and resist you when you press or lean in against its muscles. And when my back gets way out of line, I go visit her, and she works on it. I lie there on her table by the wood stove while she grinds her elbow and knee into certain pressure points, and she pulls and twists, trying to smooth it all back into place. And she uses a machine she calls Sparky, too, which I've never seen, as she uses it only on my back. It sends jolts of electricity deep into my muscles, which, she says, are but electrical fibers, like cables, conduits for electricity. And the sound that Sparky makes as she fires round after round of electricity into me, my legs and arms twitching like some laboratory frogs, is like that of a staple gun. And sometimes I imagine that it is, that she is piecing me back together, that she is pausing, choosing and selecting which treatments to use on me that day, so that I can go back out into the woods and choose and select which wood to take out and send to the faraway mills, who will then send the logs to. We are all still connected up here. Some of the connections are in threads and tatters, tenuous, but there is still a net of connectivity through which magic passes. Whenever a new car or truck enters the valley, I run and hide. I scramble to the top of a hill and watch through the trees as it passes. They can never get me. They would have to get the land itself. The scent of sweat, of fern, of hot saw blade, boot leather, damp bark. I suck these things in like some starving creature. All the books in my house now sit motionless and unexamined in their shelves, like the photos of dead relatives, dearly loved and deeply missed. Sometimes I pull them down, touch the spines, even say their names aloud, as one would the name of one's mother, mom, or one's grandmother, grandma. But then I go back out into the woods. Once, carrying a log across a frozen pond, I punched through the ice and fell in up to my chest. The cold water such a shock to my lungs that I could barely breathe. And I had to drop the log and skitter out, then build a quick fire to warm up. The heater in my old truck doesn't work. Some days, many days, it feels like two steps forward and two steps back, as the land continues to carve and scribe us at its own pace. And now when I take my pickup to the mill and offload my logs next to the millions of board feet that are streaming through it like diarrhea through a bloated pig's butt in the feedlot, what difference do I think it will make? How does my fantasy stand up there under the broad examination of reality? In protest, I haul the logs more slowly than ever. In protest, I take more time with them. I touch them, smell them. I tie the best ones to strangers. Sometimes I sit down and read the cross-section of each log, counting the growth rings. Here is where one seedling grew fast, seeking light, struggling for codominance. Here is where it reached the canopy and was then able to put more of its energy into girth and width rather than height, stability. Here, this growth ring is the drought year, then the succession of warm, wet growing years. Here, the next band of rings is where the low-intensity fire crept through and around the forest, scorching the edges of but not consuming the tree. I read each of the logs in this manner, as if reading the pages of some book. Maybe someday I will go back to books. Maybe someday I will be drawn to submerge back into the vanished or invisible world and will live and breathe theory, and maybe hope will start painting again. But right now I am hauling logs, and she is gardening, raking the loose earth with tools, though other times with her bare hands. And it feels like we are falling, and as if we are starving, and as if I must keep protesting, must keep hauling logs. We try not to buy anything anymore, especially nothing made of wood. It's all such utter, flimsy shit. One touch, one stress upon it, and it all splinters to hell. A hammer or axe handle, a wooden stepladder, a chest of drawers. It is all such hollow shit, and we are starving. Before I burned out in that third life, I was a sizzle. I remember awakening each morning to some burning smell within me, scorched metal against metal. Manatees, ivory-billed woodpeckers, whales, wolves, bears, bison. I burned for it all and did so gladly. The forest loves its fires. The reason I think I left the second life, left art, left storytelling, was because it had become so safe, so submerged. It wasn't radical enough. They say most people start out being radical when they're young and then gravitate toward moderation in middle age and then beyond moderation to the excesses of the right. But for me, it has been the opposite. As if the land itself appears inverted, mysterious, even magical, turning humans and all else inside out, in constant turmoil, constant revolution. We, all painters and writers, don't want to be political. We want to be pure and artistic. But we all know, too, I think, that we're not up to the task. What story, what painting does one offer up to refute Bosnia, Somalia, the Holocaust, Chechnya, China, Afghanistan, or Washington, D.C.? What story or painting does one offer up or create and counterbalance the ever-increasing sum of our destructions? How does one keep up with the pace? Not even the best among us are up to this task, though each tries. Like weak and mortal wood under stress, we splinter and try to act, create, heal. Some of us fall out and write letters to Congress, not novels. Others of us write songs, but they are frayed by stress and the imbalance of the fight. Some of us raise children, others raise gardens. Some of us hide deep in the woods and learn the names of the vanishing things in silent, stubborn protest. I want to shock and offend, hauling logs. My moderation seems obscene in the face of what is going on this landscape and in this country. The things, the misery for which this country is so much the source rather than a source of healing or compassion. Paint me a picture or tell me a story as beautiful as other things in the world today are terrible. If such stories and paintings are out there, I'm not seeing them. I do not fault our artist for failing to keep up with or hold in check the world's terrors. These terrors are only a phase, like a fire sweeping across the land. Rampant beauty will return. In the meantime, activists blink on and off like fireflies made drowsy over pesticide meadows. Activism is becoming the shell, the husk, of where art once was. You may see one of them chained to a gate, protesting yet another Senate-spawned clear-cut, and think the activist is against something. But the activist is for something, as artists used to be. The activist is for a real and physical thing, as the artist was once for the metaphorical. The activist, or brittle husk of artist, is for life, for sensations, for senses deeply touched, not in the imagination, but in reality. The activist is the emergency room doctor trying to perform critical surgery on the artist. The activist is the artist's ashes. And what awaits the activist ashes? Peace?